Hey, welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and you, well, you've downloaded All Ball, I think the best and most fun basketball podcast you can find. And there's plenty of other ones, and they're all really good and different. What I try and do on this pod, if it's your first time listening, is I have friends all over in the sport that I made. Some people that I don't know, I know through a friend, and I reach out to them, and then we just talk. That's about it. That's kind of the magic to it. This week, or this show, we already had one this week. We're going to kind of keep a little bit of a San Diego theme here, okay? Brian Dutcher was the last pod. This pod is Kyle Milling. Kyle grew up Poway High School, and then he went to UC Santa Barbara, then to Oregon, and then he played in Belgium for a minute, then France, stop in Lebanon, Japan, back to France. Been in France, became a coach in France, now a coach in Japan. And great dude, gave me my first beer when I was 15 years old. I actually don't know if that's true. I think I had a couple of sips of beer before that, but officially I'm going to go first beer, Kyle Milling. He was also my host on my visit to the University of Oregon. They took down Arizona. This is the year that Arizona, 96-97, when they won the national championship. So there's a history there. He's currently coaching in Japan. I find it fascinating that guys that grow up here and what they're doing now and how they got to what they're doing now. But Kyle was a tremendous player. He's like one of those classic blue collar workhorse big guys that, you know, now he would have been a center, but, you know, able to really very athletic in terms of the ability to move his feet, rebound out of his area, and then could score. And again, probably now, even though he wasn't a scorer, he just didn't have great back to the basket moves, but as a drop off guy for dunks, he's playing the five or face up shooter. But he has a very high basketball IQ, and he also really good at interpersonal relationships, understanding different guys. And I think that's why he's become a good coach, is because he just kind of understands people really, really well. Kyle Milling coaches in Hiroshima, right? What do you think of Hiroshima? Pretty amazing. And I thought we'd check in with him. This is his second year there, and he's joining us from his apartment in Japan. And I think you'll enjoy this conversation. Okay, so can I tell you my memory of you playing AAU basketball?
Maybe.
Okay. So Matt Purdy was on the team too, right?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, so, and Matt Purdy was a Santa Barbara guy too, right?
Not my year or whatever.
No, but he went to, so he grew up in Santa Barbara. He went to Northwestern. And anyway, so I remember the two of you, and I think you guys were roommates. I think you guys were roommates in Vegas. And I was going to be a freshman, but I was a whole back, so I was like 15. And I remember we had a day off the next day. This is a true story. Okay. And my experience in Vegas was really simple. Like, I was still going to Circus trying to meet girls. And you were like, let me hang out with you guys. And so I roll up into your room and we open up a drawer and there's a bunch of beer in there. And I don't know if I'd had a beer. I think that was my first beer. And all of a sudden we're like drinking beer. I felt like the coolest kid on earth drinking beer with you and Matt Purdy. That's my memory of you guys in Vegas.
So there's a few people have memories of me drinking beer.
What was your high school experience like?
I grew up in San Diego, went to Poway. It was a great experience. And it was before, but AAU was going on, but mostly in LA, of course. And I remember, I don't even know how I got in contact with your dad, but your dad, I owe a lot to your dad because he got me going in the circuit and AAU stuff. And, you know, I started playing the slam and jam in LA with you guys for your dad. And that really got me going to play at a higher level and to see a whole different basketball compared to what I was playing in San Diego.
So you're going up. Who were the others in San Diego that year?
There wasn't a lot. I mean, Poway had a lot of people going through there. Jud Bushler was before me in Poway. He was six years probably older than me. But I mean, I was one of the only guys coming out of there as far as Division I type stuff, but I can't remember too many other names.
Our last pod was with Brian Dutcher, who's the head coach of San Diego State. And trying to explain to somebody, a kid or anybody really today, over what San Diego State basketball was like then, right, is really hard because they played – Peterson was like a high school gym, right, and they sucked. And the school was like, you only went there if you wanted to party. That was it. Am I painting an accurate picture of it?
Pretty much, yeah. Like San Diego State, when I was getting ready, well, high school, they were recruiting me, and but I basically was not interested at all. Like you said, that San Diego State was wasn't an option for basically anybody coming out of San Diego or even Southern California.
Isn't that isn't it amazing?
Like, oh, it's crazy. They've really built Steve Fisher and then Dutch. Now they've really done a great job of building.
And I don't know. Facilities are incredible. And I wonder. And again, you mentioned how. And part of it's the spread of AAU basketball, but you know, one of the things my brother's always told me is like, dude, San Diego is always an under-recruited area. Tony Clark was San Diego. Was that your year?
A year or two probably before me.
Right. And he went to Arizona and then obviously became a pro baseball player. But the volume of kids coming out of San Diego now is really, I do wonder how that changed, right? Cause you've always had, it's always been a lot more diverse than like Orange County, because you had so many military kids. Yeah, people from all over. It's just interesting on how now, if you said you're from San Diego, you're like, oh, there's lots of guys from San Diego, but then there really wasn't.
Yeah. No, and I think, like you said, it's a, you know, beach community. Back then it was probably a little bit smaller than what it is now, but basketball has grown obviously a lot in San Diego and a little bit everywhere. So
why'd you go to Santa Barbara?
Well, I first committed to UCLA with Herrick, and I don't know if I was pressured to go there from my way, because UCLA was UCLA, so they offered me a scholarship. But I remember going on a recruiting trip there, and Ty Zedney, Ed O'Bannon took me around. I had a good time, but at the same time, I didn't feel quite comfortable. One little anecdote. I remember the first night, it wasn't my style, basically. The first night, they took me to the I think it was called the African American beginning of the year dance. And it was just like a weird, it was okay. You know? And then at nighttime, we went to some suite in downtown LA somewhere, and it was like a party, whatever. But it just didn't fit me. But I still committed there because it was UCLA.
So that's interesting. So here's my kind of UCLA thing. So we got season tickets when we moved out here. Like that was, I used to go to UCLA games all the time. My brother and sister went there. My sister was a cheerleader there. Probably right when you visited there. I just remember, like, again, I was a couple years removed, but the summer before so I was going to be a junior, they took Toby Bailey, like, first day of summer. And Miles Simon was my teammate and my best friend. And back then, and I don't know what it was like for you, because you didn't play for my dad all growing up, but there was, like, three big teams. And Toby played for Slam and Jam, and then there was ARC, and there was our team, like it was Orange County, San Diego, and we had J.R. Henderson. And it was just like, they took somebody else's guy. I was like, I want to play with those guys. Like I grew up not liking them. Now I have to like them. That's so weird. Yeah. And then, so I took an unofficial there, and keep in mind, even with all the ties to UCLA and how many times I was a ball boy during the Hazard era, they didn't offer me until, like, I remember I went to a game my junior year, and I went with a bunch of my guys and J.R. Henderson, who had signed there, to go there. And my tickets were way up high and everybody else's was right next to the court. And then they like asked me, like, why haven't you come back for a game? Why haven't you used our tickets? I was like, fuck, you put me up so high, the concession man wouldn't go up there. Oh, that's a mistake. We're sorry. So I go the next game I go to, I'm sitting there and they come out and get everybody for halftime and they don't get me. They literally like, yeah, let's go. And they go watch Herrick at halftime. And I didn't, and I was like, I'm no chance. So then before my senior year, I kind of blew up and they offered me. And I went on an unofficial. I went, they're just like, just come up and hang out in the fall. And I was getting ready to take my trip to Notre Dame. And I just remember it was the same thing. Like, I'd been to UCLA a bunch of times, but I hadn't ever been around the team. And this is the team that won it. And Charles had played for my dad back when he was little, and everybody liked Ed and everybody liked Tyus. And JR was there, and he was my roommate whenever we go on road trips or whatever. And Chris John Johnson was there. So there was no beef with those guys. It just didn't, it didn't feel like they were like super excited for me to be there. I was just a, just some white kid recruit. Right. Yeah. So I was like, I could just never get into it because they weren't into me. I thought that was, that was my, so did you like, did it get to the, they sent you a letter of intent? You're like, no. What, when did you decide to?
Well, I verbally committed. And then I tore my ankle springtime going into the summer. And so I was out months. I, you know, blue foot, blue calf, blue everything. And basically I committed, and they basically reneged on it, but I was kind of happy with it. And so it was kind of hard, little hard feelings in a way, because I had committed, but so they pulled the offer basically. And then, so I went back getting recruited and went up to Santa Barbara and went out on Pim's boat. And Ben Howland had recruited me forever. And went out on Penn's boat, and that fit me, my style, much, much more. And basically hanging out in Isla Vista, the beach, and that got me.
But you went on Pimmer's boat?
Yeah. Took me out on the boat.
Did he live on the boat? Is that's what everybody says he lived
on? I don't think he had a house or an apartment somewhere else, but I think he was living with his, I think it's his wife now. I don't know if he got married, but he had a place, whatever. But no, we went out on the boat, and growing up in San Diego and living on the beach, basically, that was that fit my style. So.
Okay, so who'd you have when you first got there?
As far as
players.
Coaches? Players. Rob Raymaker was my roommate, J.J. Polk, Chris Ford from Fremont, who we had played in the state quarterfinals maybe or something in high school. So they had one of the best recruiting classes that they had ever had going in there at that time.
Yeah.
So. And how good were they? Idris Jones was still there.
Idris Jones.
Yeah. And Ray Kelly, the point guard, was there when I was there. Doug Muse was there. So, no, we had a good team. So
you stayed there 2 years, right? Yeah. Well, what is it like for it? Because, okay, so there's the campus, and I almost went there when I transferred. I had my old high school girlfriend went there, and then I'd kind of be up there all the time on weekends, and finally, like, they would put the hard recruiting pitch. I was like, yeah, I can't do it. You'd already
have girlfriends in all the schools everywhere, man.
No. That's not, this is not true. But if you haven't been to UCSB's campus, I would make the case it's the greatest campus in all of America. Okay. And tell me if I'm painting the picture wrong. Okay. First, you got the eucalyptus trees, which are amazing. You have freshman, sophomore dorms, which are actually on the beach. You have a town called Isla Vista, which is literally all students, right? The gym is right there kind of in the middle. And even though it hasn't really been updated as much as it should, you know, and redone, we've all played in it, right? You played Superstar Camp back in the day or whatever. And Michael Jordan had his camp there. So it was kind of cool. But basically, you're like in a student town on the beach. And while school's hard, it's not like crazy, crazy hard. And it's the UC school where the good looking girls go. Like, sounds kind of amazing.
Oh, it's incredible. There's my second year. We had a house on the beach. We had a couch on a cliff. We used to hit golf balls out on the cliff. And one of my roommates scuba dived, and you know, it was illegal, but he used to go out there and get some lobsters at night and cook up lobsters for dinner, basically.
Who?
Well, not a player, one of my friends.
What's his name? We'll give him a little shout out so he'll download the pod.
It was Chris Fleming. Chris something. Yeah, he used to go out there and get lobsters every once in a while. We hit golf balls out on the cliff at night. No, it was incredible. Like you said, beautiful girls that go to class, half of them in bikini tops. And that was it's a whole different world out there. So.
Okay, so what was the decision like to leave?
It was hard because I kept most of it in. Why? You know, I was like a lot of kids now. I don't really know why I left, but I wasn't happy for some reason, maybe in my life. It was basketball plus just a little bit of everything. And I keep a lot of stuff to myself. My mom always used to say growing up, and because I took them as a surprise. And so it was hard. I thought about it a lot because I was freshman of the year. My freshman year was playing and starting stuff. But anyways, I decided to leave. Because I wanted more, basically. I felt like I wanted more. I don't know what, but it was a whole I don't know why I wasn't happy, but it was very hard to leave because I had my friends there and I was there 2 years. But decided to transfer. And back then, in the day, you know, there was no transfer portal either. So you put your name in somehow, but you know, I was calling schools. I had other people calling schools for me. Where nowadays, you put your name in this transfer portal, and within a couple hours, everyone's blowing up your phone, or whatever. So that was a little different too.
So how many schools did you visit?
Basically, NAU, because Ben Howland had done NAU, so I went up there to visit. Oregon, I was in contact with Stanford. I really wanted to go to Stanford, but couldn't get in because of my grades. I was eligible, but Stanford was a whole nother
grade.
And Oregon, I fell in love with Oregon. One of the main reasons Oregon, they had four or five big men. They're all seniors. So I had a redshirt, of course, and they're all going to leave. And so I kind of that just Pac-10 and back then Pac-10 and fell in love with that pretty much. So.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
Okay, so here's our We Reconnect story. So 97, right? So it's February or so of 97. And Darren Kalish was an assistant. Mm-hmm. And Darren used to be the coach of Team Avila, right? And so that's how I knew him. Tad Boyle was an assistant. Mm-hmm. And Mark Turgeon was an assistant.
Exactly.
And I didn't know Braswell. Yeah. And Bobby Braswell. And obviously mm-hmm. I knew Bobby Braswell. My dad knew all those guys. But Darren was pursuing me the hardest. And I knew of Turge. I didn't know Jerry Green at all. And so I was probably going to go to Utah and play for Majerus because they had Van Horn. They had Metula. They had all those guys. The sticking point was Andre Miller was a prop 48. Mm-hmm. And so the sale was, hey, you'll come, you'll be a sophomore. After I sat out a year at junior college, you'll be a sophomore, you'll play with Andre, and then he runs out of eligibility. And you'll have junior and senior year, you'll start there. So he said, well, you'll start in the same backcourt, and then you'll be the guy, the only guy the next 2 years. And I liked it, and they had players, and I didn't give a shit about being yelled at. I thought, you know, so I'll be fine. And what happened was, it was January, whatever. I had seen them play UC Irvine and had dinner with Rick, and he actually, you know, like illegal NCAA rule, like closed the doors and worked me out for 2 hours. Like, yeah, you can play. Let's go get some deep. So the NCAA passed rule. If you graduate in 4 years, you get that year back of eligibility. And so I would have had to share the backcourt with Andre Miller for 2 years. And I was like, no. So now I reopened it, and all of a sudden Oklahoma State made a factor. So I went to Oklahoma State, and I was coming to Oregon, and I was kind of in on Oregon, but it was also you guys were playing Arizona, and Arizona had Miles, and Miles like my best friend. So I was like, I get to go see a cool game. And I knew about Oregon, about Matt Court, because my dad had been in Oregon State back in the mid 80s. And he was like, it's the best atmosphere I've ever seen in basketball. So the Oklahoma State trip kind of got screwed up. It was like a 1.5 day trip. So I fly to Eugene, I land, and I'm at shoot around. And, you know, you're going through stuff with the starters, whatever. And I was like, is that Kyle Milling? Like, yeah, you didn't know Kyle Milling's there too? He's like, I played with him. He played with my dad. Like, I know Kyle.
Nice to see the house.
He gave my first beer, stay in my house. I didn't say all that shit. Anyway, so it was then I was like, I kind of like this play. It was super cool. The game was incredible. But this is the story I always tell. There are two reasons I didn't go to Oregon. Okay. Maybe three, but two reasons I didn't go to Oregon. So I'm sitting there and you guys beat Arizona and they carry Jerry Green off the court. You played great. The place was insane. But if you remember that year, and I don't know when they changed it, because eventually they put benches in, or they put chairs in, but they had me sit behind you guys on the bench because it was all bleachers. So my knees were literally to your guys' backs. And Jerry had a rule that, like, especially the point guard, you could sub yourself in and out of the game. So you guys, what was that little point guard? He was a stud.
Kenya
Wilkins, right? Yeah. So Kenny Wilkins is, he's calling all the defenses and he's doing all that shit, all that North Carolina stuff. And I'm like, this is cool. But every time he would sub, guys would come out and they'd be like, he has no fucking idea what he's doing. Like, what is he doing? Like, everybody was motherfucking him. Everybody was like one, like you usually have one guy grumbling, but everybody was like, dude, what is he doing? Oh my God, what is he doing? Don't sub again, right? Everybody. The second part is you guys win, celebrate. Yeah, I remember you come out and you were super cool about everything. Like, I'm sure middle of the year, last thing you want to do is show somebody around, right? Like, I just want to go and have a good fucking time. And you're like, all right, you're with me. Let's go. So we go to a party. We open the door and I went to Notre Dame. Remember, I never saw weed at Notre Dame and I'd seen weed a couple times, but I was overwhelmed by the amount of weed that I was like, oh my God. I was like, Cheech and Chong. I was like, whoa. And you weren't even smoking, but it was just like, we went into a party, went to two parties and it was literally, I had a secondhand high. I was, you know, contact high. It was crazy. Yeah. And the amount of partying, and you're like, this is how we do it. And the amount of partying, I was like, I don't know if I can handle myself.
Yeah.
And then, and then he came to my house and it was like a week before he left. And he was like, I got the greatest contract in the world. I'm never leaving. I love Oregon. And it just seems such, it just like, just, you got to give me a little something. Like, hey man, like this is a business. I might take it. I might not. Got to see what they do money wise. But it was just not, it was so like, I'm not leaving. And then like a week later, I see him putting on the Tennessee hat. I was like, this guy's bullish. I'm out. Now I've since talked to Coach Green. I love him. He's a nice, very nice man.
Yeah.
But that was my, what do you remember about?
Oregon. Well, Oregon, I loved it. I mean, like you say, it was definitely, there's a lot of Cheech and Chong, could be a film there, basically. A lot of Cheech and Chong scenarios could be filmed there, but all the Matt Court, as far as the basketball goes, like your dad had told you, and you experienced, I think it was Arizona's last loss before they won the national championship, I think.
Yes.
But the ambiance and the feeling of Matt Court was incredible because it was like three levels. The top level looking down at you, that place used to just rock. And all his home games and experience was great. And I wanted to get that higher level basketball. And, I touched it in the Pac-12, Pac-10 back in the day. But I had a great experience in Oregon. For me, I wanted to change. Oregon's it's a beautiful place. It rains a lot. But growing up in Southern California and then getting experience a little bit something different without having to go to the East Coast, it was a good experience. Almost like, you know, it's, I want to say it's a different culture up in Oregon, but it's a different way of life and a different way people live. So it was good. It was a good time.
Is it, what's it like to see what that athletic program has become? Like, it's not just football, like the whole thing is like state of the art, completely different than when you were there.
Yeah. Yeah. When I got there, I mean, they've always had Nike money. And when I got there, I think it was what, 96, 98 in there. And the football team had made it to the Rose Bowl, I believe, the first time in forever. And so they were just getting rolling. They had some new facilities going. And so it was building. When I, and the basketball team, the year I redshirted was the first time they made the NCAA tournament, and I don't know how many years. So they were, it was slowly building, and now it's just exploded to a whole nother level. But
I've always wondered this. I think I experienced this some. Obviously, you played a ton. Now you're coaching in Japan, you've coached in France. I always thought that those places that are special, that are packed, where you have incredible energy, it's really hard to play in the minor leagues, especially, and to a lesser extent overseas, because sometimes you're playing in empty gyms, you know, or half built gyms, and there's not the connection with your teammates. There's not the connection with the fans, you know, and again, not every situation is like that. You've coached and played in a lot of them. But I always thought that that's one of those things where it's like, honestly, the reason that Duke guys, I don't think most of them could ever play overseas or could play minor leagues. Kentucky guys, the same thing, because they're so used to every gym they walk into is full. Mm-hmm. And so what was that like for you later on in life to experience that and that energy? And then now you got to kind of generate your own energy.
Yeah. No, like I said, that's why a lot of guys, when they hit overseas their first year or two, they struggle a lot. One, it's not just the atmospheres, but college athletes, they get spoiled a lot. They get treated very well. and you go overseas, and all of a sudden you're, in college, you're sleeping in the Hilton or the Marriott with a queen size or king size bed, and you head overseas your first year, and you most likely sleeping in a small little hotel room, a single bed, sharing a room with someone else, where you're almost rubbing legs with the guy at night, and so yeah, little things, the road trips, the food, to empty gyms, to having to wash your own practice jerseys, to all that stuff, and so it is an adjustment. So if you're not ready to adjust and to adapt to your surroundings, and many guys that struggle their first year or two, expecting to have their stuff washed, expecting to travel nice, and then a lot of guys get cut their first year or even second year, and they finally adjust and bring their stuff down a little bit, and then they adapt.
Okay, so you get done playing in college, then what?
I head over to, I had an agent, he got me a job in Belgium. It's basically first, I got cut like many guys do, like I said. And I played maybe 6 weeks there. And I was playing okay,
Where in Belgium? Where in Belgium?
Ghent.
Where?
Ghent.
What's that like?
Gaunt or Ghent. It's a super nice town. It's super nice. One of the bigger cities in Belgium. But so I was there maybe a month or two, and
why did you think you got cut?
They said I was inconsistent, and they wanted more scoring, probably because same type of thing. I wasn't a massive scorer, but they wanted me to shoot. There was a bottom team, and they wanted more scoring, and same like many young players. Maybe I wasn't taking it as serious as I needed to, because there, even the preseason games in Europe are cutthroat. You got to win. You got to perform. And so, I had one game at score 20, the next game score 6, one game score 20, one game score 8. And so they backed me, but then my agent found a job basically the next day or two. So that's when I headed to France and packed up my bags. I had about 4 bags. Got on a train. There's no cell phones. They told me some guy was going to pick me up in Nantes, my first team in France, and had to change trains and Lille, I remember, but in Lille, you got to change train stations, but I didn't know that. So I got Lille Nord, and I had to go to Lille Europe. Some of that, but I had like 4 bags. I was waiting in the train station that I arrived in, and all of a sudden, 10 minutes to go, and I didn't see my train coming up, and I was sitting there, young, dumb American. Some lady, luckily, spoke a little bit of English. She came to help me, saw my ticket. She said, "Oh, it's over there. So she actually took 2 of my bags and basically sprinted to the other train station, got on there about a minute before my train left, and sweating bullets because it was still hot as hell in Europe. Got to Nantes. I had no idea who was picking me up or where. I was worried about missing the train because I didn't know how I'd contact anyone. Anyways, got off the train, and there was a little Frenchman sitting there picking me up and took me to my apartment. And start a new life in Nantes.
So you go to Nantes, and what's life like? What do you remember life like then? You're in your early 20s, And okay, so did you have a car?
Yeah, they gave me a little station wagon, an old little station wagon thing. So I loved it. Nantes was a great city. And I don't know, I went there with an open mind, and I like to visit a lot of stuff. And, obviously I didn't speak any French, and there's no internet, no FaceTime, nothing like that. So I used to watch game shows when I was bored to try to learn French, because I could understand the numbers and a lot of the game shows, they have words on the screens and stuff. So I took some, I had the cassette tapes and tried to learn French, but I'd be out almost every day off. I'd go drive to Normandy, drive to different cities to go visit the Chateau region in Angers, go up to Paris. And so I like to visit a lot and get out and see a lot of things and stuff. So that kept me busy, and it forced me to go out and meet people and try to learn the language as well. Cause now you just kind of sit in your apartment and go crazy. So
how many years until you felt comfortable with the language?
Probably 2 or 3. The guys on my team, they first teach you all the bad first words, how to pick up girls or stuff like that, and then slowly gets going, how to eat, how to order food, how to order drinks, and I could understand it more easier before you start speaking it. And then I met a French woman, my wife, got married a couple years later. And
how'd you meet her?
Out on the dance floor, huh?
Do you remember, like, in Paris?
I think I met her on a Halloween night, something like that.
So think about this for a second, right? Had you missed that train?
Yeah.
They might have cut you. They might be like, "Yeah, Mel Kelly, fuck this guy, right? Like, get rid of him." Right? You don't. This old, some lady speaks English, enough English, gets you to a train. You're sweating bullets. You get there. If not for that, if you hadn't been cut in Belgium, if you just stopped messing around in Belgium, you still would have been in Belgium, drinking Belgian beer, married to a Belgian woman. Instead, you married to a French woman.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're dancing. You dance with her, right? I mean, you're the. You're back then you were a Greek god, you're gigantic human being with flexing muscles. What did you say to her? Did you go to your
friend? Do you speak English? Do you speak English? And she said, yes, a little bit, like they all say. And she actually did speak pretty good English. So that's how we started, basically just talking, because she spoke English basically. So, and she was a pretty girl, pretty woman. And met her that night. And then, from there, the rest is history. Over 20 years later, a couple sons and the granddaughter now too.
Jesus, you're old.
Yeah,
and your granddaughter. That's old. Okay, so, but you didn't stay. You only how many years in Nantes? Only one, right?
1 year in Nantes. Yeah.
Okay, and then you went to Ruel.
Well, in between, I made a little pit stop in Lebanon for about a month, and that was an experience.
What was that like?
But I thought I had a job. I went out there and there was about 30 guys on a tryout for basically one or two spots. I don't know about 30, but at least 10 to 15 guys for like one spot. We're all in the hotel together too. So all of us showed up and like, what are we doing here? And it was like, there's not 10 jobs. There's one job or two jobs or whatever. And the guy who picked me up at the airport, he was going through the streets and he was basically running red lights. And I was like, going fast as hell. And I was like, what are you? He's like, oh, it's Christmas lights, the traffic lights, Christmas lights. I'm like, hey, moment. So basically no traffic rules, no nothing. We're in a hotel, like a bunch of guys fighting for a job. Go to practice. It's practice supposed to be at 10. They pick us up, drop us off at the gym. Coach shows up. Practice supposed to be at 10. Coach showed up at like 10:30. Anyway, it was – I had to get out of there. And then went back to France about a few weeks later, and then went to.
Now, did you go back home in between?
No, I stayed with my wife or girlfriend at the time, and then I was in France, and then went to Rouen, played there.
Wait, so I mean, your French had to be much better then. This is, you said 2 or 3 years, but
yeah, that was about my second. In Lebanon too, it's a French speaking country, but they speak a little bit of everything there, but. But Lebanon was nice. I mean, there's parts of its cities was destroyed. And then there's the other part where they had TGI Fridays and the Western part. But anyways, ended up in Rouen in Paris in Pro B again, the second division, where that's what Nantes was. And spent a year in Paris, which was a lot of fun too.
And did she come with you or did she just visit?
That actually I had gone to Japan. My second year I was in Japan. Third year was Lebanon. So
I forgot about Japan.
Yeah.
What was that? So how did you continue a relationship when you're in Japan and she's in France and there's no internet? Just call her?
Well, she came to Japan for a few months actually. So
she did.
Because when I was flying back from Japan, some agent, Japanese agent who I think my brother got me, someone got me in contact. I basically flew in from France, went to LA basically the next day, did a workout in front of two Japanese, the manager and some coach did an individual workout, basically signed a contract in their hotel room a couple hours later.
What I had heard about Japan back then, and tell me if I'm wrong, you guys only played like once a week, right? Mm-hmm. And there was like a limit, like you could only make, like most guys only made like $1 or $1.25, like was like the max. But the whole thing was like, yes, you only play once a week, but you don't practice as much and they just don't grind you as much. And mm-hmm. Is that your recollection of it?
Yeah, well, we played 16 games in like 8 months, basically. And I had, yeah, like 6 weeks off. So I flew home that year for Christmas, which like in Europe, you know, you're playing all the time. And I had 12-month contracts. But there was a lot of guys making, you know, 100, 125. But there was a lot of guys who stayed over there were making big money, or, you know, 300, 400, 500, stuff like that, even back in the day, the company teams. But, no, there's a lot less games. You played 16, but you're guaranteed your money. There was no problems. And I was home for 3 months, and they're wiring the money home. We're in Europe at that time.
You never knew. So what was it like to live in Japan, where everything seems pretty tight quarters and you're not exactly Japanese size?
Yeah. Well, I love the experience again, because the culture was so different compared to European culture, what I'd been in, and American culture, obviously. And I was with a great group of guys. I don't know if you know Derek Grimm, played in Missouri.
He's sure.
At UCLA. So we live in the same basically apartment complex. So he was right across from me. And Tim Mason, he went to SMU. He was the other American. But we had an American coach, and we all lived in the same apartment complex, and played a lot of cards, a lot of tonk, and a lot of drank quite a bit of Asahi and Sapporo in between the stuff. But no, Osaka was it's a huge, incredible city. The first time you get downtown, you see all the lights and everything. It was I loved it.
Yeah, very clean too, right?
Oh, incredibly clean, respectful. No one, but you know, trash. There's no trash anywhere. It's rude to even walk down the street eating, basically. And everyone puts everything in the trash. As far as respecting the rules of basically society, you can't go any, can't get any better. So,
what about France? What is different about French culture that you learned and absorbed and liked?
There's a lot of people ask me, what do you like better, French or France or America? I always say my mind is almost a franglais, a mix between the two, because is one better than the other? I can't say that, but obviously you can't have the best of both worlds either. But there's many things in the French culture that I styles of life and that I like a lot. French culture is a lot slower, the lifestyle, and obviously in American style, you know, Sunday basically is a day off, rest day. People are running around to 10 AAU games. Having to stay busy. There's a time to take time for yourself, you can almost say, and or your family, and be at home and relax. And so there's a lot of different things that.
What's the best French food to eat?
I'd probably go with some duck. I like the duck. Well, the desserts. I'm a big dessert guy. So moule au chocolat, the chocolate cake with where it kind of oozes out in the middle. There's obviously fresh breads. That's a little classic thing. But some of the chocolate cake stuff, dessert, that's what I'll go with anytime. So.
And now you've always been a beer guy. You a wine guy in France? You still a beer guy?
I like wine, but I kind of stick to my beer.
So is there a German beer that you always get, or what was when you're in France? Is there how, what do you?
We got the old 1664. I know they sell in the States, and Heineken in France is obviously very popular. But in France, everything's about 10 years behind. States is a lot of cultural stuff, so the beer markets have gone crazy. All the microbreweries and brass, each city basically has a couple different places that make their own beer now. The IPAs, the pale ales, and the Belgian beer. I like Belgian beer too.
Sure. So find out okay, so you make your way back to France. Okay. Mm-hmm. And at what point in time, when did you get married?
After Japan. About a year after Japan, so 2000. I better say it right if my wife listens to this.
So now you're married. So you're kind of so was it like I have to be in France, or was it it just worked out for to stay in France as long as you stayed in France?
Well, eventually I got my French passport. So a team, Paul Ortez, who played in the EuroLeague. I played in the EuroLeague 1 year, but anyway, they signed me to like a 3-year deal, and because I was going to become French, so I was going to play as a Frenchman. So, and that's one reason why I stayed in France most of the time after. So,
and you only play 1 year at Pau, right? Then you play with Toulon after that?
Yeah, I played in Toulon 7 or 8 years. Basically set up shop there. We still have a, that's basically home in a year. And we have a house there and stayed there 7, 8 years. I finished in Monaco in the lower divisions.
So what is it like to buy a house in France? So like the house you own,
yeah. Okay.
Is it a house? Is it in the countryside? Is it a like a townhouse? Is it an apartment? Like what is it?
Well, the house we have now, you know, it's a house. It's about a, what, Hier, it's a town called Hier. It's near Toulon. It's about a, well, maybe five minute bike ride and 15 minute walk to the beach, French Riviera. The town's about 60,000. So it's a, no, it's a beautiful place. And on one side of it's like wine fields going up on a mountain. And then you go the other way and you're to the beach. So it's a, no, it's a little three bedroom house. Got a pool. Pétanque, you can play some pétanque, a boule. The balls you play, bocce ball, whatever it's called.
Yeah, bocce ball. Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, the French, they played on the clay.
Okay, so you grew up in Poway, which is not really near the beach, right? But it's still San Diego. But then you went to UCSB, which is right on the beach. Oregon is, UO is like an hour from the beach. But what is a beach, like a bike ride from the beach in France, like what's life like in comparison to when, again, like you have to remember most people listening to this are stateside. So when we think of beach towns, you got people think of the Jersey Beach, they think of California beaches. What is your, that area in France like in terms of being beachy? Like do people wear flip flops? Right? Do people surf? Right? Are you like super French man where you're going Speedo, you're going banana hammock when you go to the beach? Give me the beach thing.
Well, me, I say a little San Diego style, but as far as flip-flops and the regular swim shorts, but the beach, the town we live in, it's kind of, I wouldn't say it's countryside. It's basically countryside. That's what I like about it because it's not the big, if you see on TV, the French Riviera, Nice or Marseille, we got the big buildings and, you know, overlooking the beaches right on top of the beach. It's basically a forest type thing on the beach. So basically you can go to the French beaches. You got some topless. And then the beach closest to my house, you can go a little bit down further and you got the nudist area. And then you go a little bit further, you know, you got a little bit of everything. So, the nudist area is a little, interesting at times because
yeah.
It's kind of right. You got the families, you got people just setting up shop normal. And it's not, the nudist is not people you really want to go check out either. Cause it turns out to be, some pretty special, human beings hanging out there. So it's a, that's, you know, some, basically a lot of people don't, women especially, and me as well, you don't really want to send your kids to walk down that.
So you're playing in Toulon for all that time, right? At what point in time, and that's different, like lots of people play in, when they play in Europe, it's like a 1 year, they're always in and out, maybe two. At what point in time did you get to where like, this is home? I'm not looking to bounce to the next team every year. Do you remember when that took place?
Yeah, well, probably about a year, maybe in the first or second year I was there that this team, because the area, it's actually a team where there's a lot of, especially French players, but a lot of people, and there's two older American players. I don't know if you're Alan Bunting, he's in his 60s or 70s, but and Tom Schneider, but there's a couple of American guys who had played there before me who ended up setting up shop. And French players get there. Once they get to that team, many people don't want to leave because it's such a nice place. And so for me, once I got there, it felt like home almost, being in Southern California in a way. And because the size of the town, everything about it was kind of fit my style. And I was happy. The basketball was fine. And first division, but first division basketball playing on the beach in a beautiful area. Couldn't go wrong. So, and I didn't really want to move around. But, you know, we eventually had a kid. We had kids and to move around, family and stuff. There was no real reason. And the team liked me. I liked them. So there was no reason to move. So.
Who are your favorite Americans that you played with?
Favorite Jason Rowe. He went to Buffalo. He was a play. He was another one. He stayed at least 3 years, if not 4 years, in Toulon. With me, Sean Colson was one of the point guards.
I played against Sean Colson a bunch. He was great. He's a big basketball trainer now.
Yeah,
he kicked my ass a ton in USBL. He's a really good player.
Shante Rogers played there a year. A
sure.
From Washington.
George Washington played against him in college.
Yeah.
He could score. He could play.
Yeah. No, and, you know, Zelagal was guys were extra on the shorter side, you know, to perform at that level, being at that size, too. It's a whole other
thing. I felt like France, like what separates it in terms of first and second division, faster than a lot of Europe. Mm. And, you know, you have like a lot of American point guards, which speeds it up. Mm-hmm. But you also have a lot of the French kids who are either from the French West Indies. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a lot more athleticism from the French players. Mm-hmm. So whereas when you play, you know, I played in Russia, I felt like, you know, even though you had some great players, it was still more kind of classic old school Europe grabbing and holding. Mm-hmm. I always felt like when I played in France, I played in Clermont-Ferrand for just a month, but mm-hmm. it was like the whole game was up and down. It was amazing. It was perfect for me. Mm-hmm. I was like, man, why didn't I come here right away? Is that an accurate depiction of French basketball?
Yeah. Well, French basketball is probably the most athletic league outside of America for sure in Europe. And pretty much everyone says the same thing because the French players are very, well, they probably have the second most amount of NBA players in the league, I think, France. So it's a very athletic league. French players are just as long and as athletic as the American players, basically. And so it's a very physical league too, because everyone can jump, everyone can run, and everyone can go on. They're just as long as athletic. Like you said, the West Indies, the French islands, as well as there's many African countries who speak French. So a lot of the immigrants, instead of immigrating to some other European countries, they'll immigrate to France where they speak the language. And eventually, you know, the African culture gets into
France. It's very diverse. I mean, that's really what it is. You get diversity, and you get, and those athletes are not all playing soccer like they are in some European countries. They're actually playing basketball.
There's even, like, I mean, a lot of NBA scouts go to like France when they go to watch the young kids, or even walking around the street, and they can't believe the amount of talent, like physical talent or bodies that's there or whatever. And you go to Paris and be like 6'9", 7 footers walking down the street, you know, but they're not basketball players, but they're just that length and the size, whatever. There's a lot of talent there. So.
All right, that's the end of part one of my discussion with Kyle Miller. That's what it's like for him to play overseas for all those years, what it was like to transfer. I mean, you heard it. It was really good. Part two will drop, I don't know, tomorrow or the next day, and it's about how he got into coaching. It's really kind of a fascinating story because so many of us, you know, we play and then you're like, it's done. And he played really till kind of his body let him down and he was just done. And then you're like, what's next? You know, when you're playing in Pro B in France, even as a Frenchman, you know, you're making likely low six figures. You know, you stack all that money away and then you got to figure out what's next in your life. How did he become a first division coach in France? How did he get to coaching in Japan? What was it like during quarantine, during COVID, especially in France? And he's got an amazing story, amazing, partially disturbing, but amazing story about how he got a ticket from a police officer during quarantine. So all that's upcoming on the next episode. In the meantime, a reminder to download, subscribe, make sure you rate us as well, write a review, and listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show daily, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, foxsportsradio.com, the iHeartRadio app. Or you can download that podcast wherever you download podcasts. I'm Doug Gottlieb. Thanks for listening. This is All Ball.